Hello and welcome to Tonebenders, where we talk with the sonic artists behind our favorite films, games, and series. My name is Tim Muirhead, and I will be your host today as we go back over the films that are nominated for the Achievement in Sound Oscar this year. I was lucky enough to cover all the films up for the award this year over the past many months. Some of the episodes came out all the way back in the summer, while others are more recent, including our very last episode about Oppenheimer. If you already listened to that episode, I saved a clip special for today, so there will be some new conversation to hear about that film. But first, let's start with Mission Impossible: Dead Reckoning. This is a great episode, as talking with James Mather is always a good time. I had a really hard time picking a clip from my talk with James, but I went with this section about the Fiat car chase scene and how it is both crazy intense and really surprisingly funny.
It's like Buster Keaton. It goes back to those old movies where it's from the sublime to the ridiculous, and the contrast is what makes it so funny. And the notion that you see the plush sports car, Anuka, of course, you know, it's a bit of a slight to other action movie heroes that we know that would have gone for the sports car. Ours gets the most impossible car to try and evade such a battle tank of a car that. It was easy for us to make it funny. It's visually, you watch it mute and it's funny. You know, the humor is there in the looks, the humor is there in the design of the choice of the car, the design of the car. So when we went and recorded the actual car that they had put a Tesla motor into the Fiat to get it to be electric, we went to record it, and you know, it's a quiet engine. It doesn't make a lot of noise, but the car itself made a lot of creaks and groans and metal twists and bangs and sounds tinny and a little bit like the house made of straw. You know, a strong wind would blow it over. We started from the get-go. The moment it comes out, it's got this little squeaky thing and it kind of stops into a skid, and there's a character that we immediately associate with that car, which is that it's got bravado and it's got chutzpah, but it's a tiny little weedy car. It's a bit like the kind of Transformers Bumblebee type, you know, it's the smaller, but it still thinks it's got something to prove, which it has. What's under the bonnet is far more dynamic than anything else on the street. And it wasn't hard to play along with that. I think the challenge was really, how small can we make it? How feeble can we make it without it being unrealistic, in order that the Hummer, the car that Paris is chasing them in, is that much bigger and heavier and gruntier and, you know, muscular. And that comparison, that contrapoint, is key to so many moments within the chase, like the donutting in the square at the bottom of the Spanish Steps. All those moments where you're just looking at it going, this is utterly farcical, yet totally plausible. You know, this is... If a car was so overpowered, you know, from the get-go, when Ethan puts his accelerator on and goes flying into the shop front, that car was really hard to drive. It's, you know, you put an engine with that much torque in it, in a car that size, it's gonna twitch. So you get that impression. There's a lot of reality in that. That's what made that scene so exciting to play with. It's different. It's not been done before. It's not homage to another film, French Connection, or any other film that has a car chase like that. It is unique, and it is a wonderful vehicle for their chemistry. You know, it not only is it fun for the audience to see this action scene, it's also a really good opportunity for us to see this relationship develop through humor and nuance and surprise, and the fact that they swap places when they don't expect to, and the fact this it's wonderfully choreographed, wonderfully thought out, and brilliantly performed. We recorded a lot of tire squeaks. We have tire squeaks in our library. We found towards the end of the process that the tire squeaks were starting to sound shrill. And it was something that Tom picked up on when he listened to it in one of the previews. And he felt we could step back on some of the comic squealing to allow the character of the engine to be a bit more, but without losing the squeal. So actually, you know, in most cases with soundtracks, you kind of overdo it slightly in order to be able to subtract and take away and expose moments and create timing that works better. You're just constantly dialing it in to improve. We took away some of the very high frequency, the 2K screeches, And what it did is it made it more realistic. It stopped it being slightly comic and made it far more realistic. And it also allowed the engine acceleration out of turns just to be a bit more recognizable. I mean, there's a scene after the Spanish Steps. The car is then being chased through streets and it's narrowly missing oncoming traffic and it's going through red lights. And it's at that point you start relying on the other vehicles' skids and horns and physicality to give you the impression that you're in that very small, vulnerable car and that all the other sounds around you are far more threatening. So the character arc of the sound design for those vehicles changes all the way through that sequence. So you start off, and specifically as the little Fiat goes down the steps and you hear those as it's shuddering, the tires are squeaking going down the steps. And that was designed to give you the sense that they were trying to control it, not herring down the steps at full pace, but reluctantly ending up going down these steps. And the skids give you that sense that they're not going at full pelt. They're actually desperately trying not to go too fast and crash. And then by the end of the scene, the skids from the Fiat are almost subliminal compared to the horns and the traffic oncoming, which is now another threat. And then you've always got this Hummer that appears out of rear right or rear left, this huge, gutsy V8 engine. And it's like having an orchestra, you know, it's playing different frequencies and different instruments at different times to allow the audience to feel that they're compelled and enthralled and engaged.
So that was James Mather talking about his work on Mission Impossible: Dead Reckoning. It's from Tonebenders episode 225. If you missed it last summer when it came out, I suggest you seek it out as it was a really fun talk. James has a way of expressing his excitement over his sound work that I find really engaging. Okay, next up will be Richard King talking about Oppenheimer. Many of you will have just listened to this episode recently since it came out just before this one, but I saved a clip so there would be something new to hear today. We will start things off by hearing Richard talk about the reading he did as research before he even started working on Oppenheimer, and then that will segue into a clip about designing the sound of the test site explosion. Okay, here's Richard King.
You know, what life was like on this military base that was mostly peopled by civilians who chafed the military's rules. And so it was like the military were like the parents and the scientists were like the little children that had to be watched and corralled, make sure they don't wander off. It was an uneasy relationship, but it was home to these people for a couple of years. And so we tried to kind of give it that busy, homey feeling, while at the same time conveying the idea that it's a military base by having loudspeaker announcements occasionally happening. And we hear military vehicles rumble by when we're inside. So I think all of that was time well spent for me to get just a visceral idea of what those people went through a little bit. You know, the super amazing thing to me is I read every book that I could find on Oppenheimer and the Manhattan Project, and there are a bunch of them. And it was amazing to me how many of these little anecdotes Chris got into the script. Little nuggets of information, like the fact that the Secretary of War Stimson had honeymooned in Kyoto, so that he took that off the target list. All these little interesting little tidbits that are just there as detail were all accurate. The film is incredibly accurate historically. And I find that so impressive that a film that's so dramatically engaging as a story is all true. And he reshaped it into this kind of kaleidoscopic, what I think of as a kaleidoscopic kind of God's eye view of the entire situation and the entire period by jumping around in the timeline. You kind of start to get the entire sense of what all was going on, what the people, what the personalities were like, what the situation felt like, the incredible importance that was being placed on this project because the Germans were working on a bomb and God forbid they should get it first. I am constantly amazed at Chris's genius, and the script, after I read it, I was just knocked out. So you can learn a lot from the film, but it's not a documentary, and it's and the fact that he gives us all this information in such a engaging and dramatic way, I just think is great. That pause is one of the things that makes the actual explosion so powerful, because the audience expects the bang to happen when the flash happens. So the flash happens, we don't hear a bang. The audience is kind of off put for a while, and they wonder, if are we in Oppenheimer's head? Are we in some dream state that he's entered? It gives us a chance to appreciate, if that's the word, the visual awe of what they're seeing and what they're feeling in that moment, just seeing that fireball. And the shockwave hits, and it's almost a relief. It's almost like reality has returned, and everyone can relax. And, you know, his brother says it worked. They can all kind of breathe a sigh of relief that they're not all dead and that they didn't burn the world up. One of the descriptions of the test regarding sound was that the sound seemed to linger forever, that it was like thunder, but not like natural thunder. It had a different quality to it as the sound was bouncing around the low hills surrounding this large valley that the tower was in. The shockwave hits, everything in the bunker shaking, vibrating. The physical bunker itself is creaking and groaning and withstanding the pressure of this wind, which is hitting the bunker, and which is what we hear kind of following the initial impact of the shockwave, which I really wanted to be a super transient event with no buildup, no little lump. Imagine like a cinder block wall traveling at you at the speed of sound. That's what I wanted it to kind of feel like to the audience, just this enormous sound that's not really an explosion. I mean, it has explosive elements in it, but it's also, it has a kind of an odd quality to it. I didn't want to just use the sounds of chemical explosions and then just play them louder for the atomic explosion. I wanted to try to find some new way to present it. And per my reading of all the first-hand descriptions, I think we captured it sonically really well. Really proud of that.
I think maybe Richard King is in the driver's seat right now for the Sound Oscar this year with Oppenheimer. The film has some really bold choices in it for sound. Many people really love it, while others have been somewhat put off by it. I have to admit, I fall on the side of admiring the work, while one of my closest work colleagues feels the exact opposite, and we've had some spirited conversations about it since last summer. In addition to Oppenheimer, Richard King is also nominated for his work on Maestro. We had another four members of the sound team on Tonebenders in episode 247 to talk about the massive orchestra scene that serves as kind of a climax to the film. So here's Tom Ozanich talking about his job doing the final Atmos mix of the music in that scene.
I think I had 20-ish or so 5-1 stems from that. Obviously broken into all the groupings of, you know, the strings and the brass and the choir and soloists and all that. And, you know, I think one of the crazy things about this was just the guts it took to do this as this sort of one big take, one, you know, and there are a couple of other shots in there. When Bradley kind of decided to do that as one big bold take, there was a lot on the line, you know, a lot of a lot could go wrong with that. And it's kind of magic, really, in a way that it happened. And those are the kinds of things you want to somehow find, whether you're making a movie or you're recording an album. You know, everybody's looking for those like magic things that happen that you couldn't really almost plan for. You know, you do all the planning and then you hope for the magic. And obviously I think he got it. It's gone through these guys plus the scoring mixer and everybody before it gets to me. And then I've got to take all that and, you know, kind of imagine it, like, what can we do in this theatrical space to put us in the cathedral. It's driven largely, I mean, there's a big part of it is the shots and, you know, what's happening visually and the geography of that. But overall, it's really driven by the emotion of where we've come in the movie to that point, and knowing like this is a huge climax scene for the movie. I mean, it's not just about the performance. It's like Jason was saying, it's about their relationship and, you know, the meaning of this to their relationship. And, you know, this is a big turning point that puts them back together. So there's a lot going on, you know, and it plays out with us connecting with Lenny as he's doing this heartfelt performance. And so that was all of that weighs into how do you play this, you know, trying to push the drama, you know, pull back some things that, you know, are going to allow us to, you know, not just be sort of overwhelmed and overpowered by this giant piece of music that goes for, like you said, 6 minutes or whatever. You know, we want to have the delicacy, you know, of where it starts and, you know, there's a few moments in it where it settles down a little bit and builds back up. And we want to also get to these giant epic peaks in there as well. To me, it's like I'm driving that with a thinking always about the emotion. And so consequently, there's certain things where it's like, okay, I want a little more low end here. I want the swell to just wash over us and be overwhelming. And
there's one point where the kettle drums kick in and it just kind of shakes the whole room. And it's a really magical moment.
Yeah. I mean, that's exactly one of those points I'm saying is like, you have to do this. It has to be this epic thing. I mean, pushing the boundaries of, you know, sort of what we've heard before and being immersed in that. I want it to feel connected to the screen and what we're looking at. But at the same time, I want to create a three-dimensional space that extends the screen out to wrap around us. You know, I don't want to be stuck with it being on the screen, but I do want it to be anchored. You know, I want it to be there. I want it to feel like that is tangibly what we're looking at. And playing with those elements, you know, again, some of that is motivated by the geography of what's happening. You know, the choir is back behind us on the right, or now we've turned and we're looking right at them. As the camera moves, all that stuff is subtly shifting so that it feels like it's in the geography appropriate to the picture. And yet at the same time, you can't get too heavy-handed with that, or you're going to imbalance the mix. You know, it's going to be like, oh, well, everybody's over there in the back corner. Well, that's not going to sound good. But you ought to sell that feeling still. That's the trick, is kind of figuring out the placement and the balance to make us still in the middle of it and yet feel like the parts are coming from where the parts are in general.
That was Tom Ozanich talking about mixing the huge orchestra scene in Bradley Cooper's Maestro, which is nominated for the Achievement in Sound Oscar this year. I'm actually surprised Maestro doesn't have more buzz around it just in general at this year's Oscars. I know I really, really enjoyed the film. Tom is another double nominee along with his mixing partner, Dean Zupancic. They both also were on the faders for The Creator, the little sci-fi film that could. We had the supervising sound editors Ethan van der Rijn and Eric Adal on Tonebenders for episode 249. Eric had a really surprising take on how explosions can't just be big bangs. They have to connect to the story points where they occur in the film.
And then for the explosions, figuring out ways to kind of make them interesting, but also serving the emotional beat. What's the purpose in this scene, in this moment for it? So sometimes I wanted them to be like beautiful in a weird way, like the haunting, not just percussive and giant. So I'm a fan of low end. I'm a fan of bass drops. We did play with that a lot. And, you know, and sometimes that's just like kick drums that we would vary speed down from a higher frequency into a lower frequency. So we switch from the mains into subwoofer purely. And then you can bring in the reality of it based on whatever that the power of that explosion, shockwave that comes out of it, or debris and dust. And towards the end of the film, where we start to see some of the true tragedy happening, with some of these explosions. We be on a wide shot, more like an exhale. That's one thing I love about sound, is you can be really abstract with it. It's an abstract art, and the purpose is, you know, you don't need to be literal. The approach should be, how are we telling a story, physical story, but also the emotional story? That's the power of sound. You can use something totally different to what's actually on screen, but when you combine them, if emotionally correct, then kind of the magic trick, I guess.
Okay, so those are four of the nominees. We did full episodes on all those movies. This last one, though, is a bit of a smuggle, a bit of a little trick. We had Johnny Byrne on to talk about his work on the film Poor Things. Now, I got to go see a really far advanced screening of Poor Things. It was long before Zone of Interest came out, and Johnny Byrne is also the supervising sound editor on Zone of Interest, which is nominated for the Oscar this year. So since I hadn't seen Zone of Interest when I talked to him, I had heard from other friends who had seen it that it was absolutely amazing. I couldn't really ask any informed questions, so I just asked Johnny, what was it like working on these two very different films?
Gosh, they are two such different films, and both of them had their own COVID-related hiatus issues and stuff. So they did very much run concurrently, although over such a large period of time. The Zone of Interest is a Holocaust movie, for those who don't know, and it's one where there are almost two films at play. There's a sort of family drama that you see, and then there's an entirely different film, which is a soundscape of horror coming over the camp wall, and you never go in the camp and you never actually see anything awful, but it's kind of, you know, probably the most violent film I've ever worked on, and that's all in the sound. And I was so grateful when I had to pause working on that for about a month to go and mix Poor Things. it was the perfect relief right at the right moment. I remember actually going for a walk with Yorgos around Berkeley Square in London and years back, and saying, I think Jonathan's film is going to come the same time as yours, and I'm not sure. I hope it doesn't. And he said, well, you've obviously got to do both. Jonathan's an extraordinary filmmaker. You know, I'm sure you can find a way. Don't worry about it. So, yeah, two very different films. The Q&As that I've been doing in New York and London film festivals and stuff, if I ever lose my train of thought and kind of come to in a room, I have to think very carefully about the tone at which I angle the conversation.
Okay, so there you have it, a little walk down memory lane on the five films nominated for the Achievement in Sound Oscar in 2024. Let me know what you think is going to win the award, or if there's another film that you feel was left behind in the nominations. Thanks for listening today. Please feel free to tell your colleagues in the sound community about our show. The best way for us to grow is by word of mouth. We really appreciate it. My name is Tim Muirhead, and I'll be talking to you again soon. Thanks for listening to Tonebenders.
Tonebenders is produced by Timothy Muirhead, Renee Coronado, and Teresa Moro. Theme music is by Mark Strait. Send your emails to info@tonebenderspodcast.com. Follow us on Twitter via @TheTonebenders and join Tonebenders Podcast on Facebook. Support this podcast. You can use our links when you shop with Amazon or B&H, or leave us a tip. Just go to tonebenderspodcast.com and click the support button. Thanks for listening.
Are you looking for more audio-related podcasts to listen to? Tonebenders is part of the Audio Podcast Alliance, featuring a hand-picked selection of the very best podcasts about sound. Be sure to hear the latest episodes from our friends in the community at audiopodcast.org.